Welcome to Creating Wealth with Jason Hartman. During this program, Jason is going to tell you some really exciting things that you probably haven't thought of before, and a new slant on investing. Fresh new approaches to America's best investment that will enable you to create more wealth and happiness than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine, self-made multimillionaire who not only talks the talk, but walks the walk. He's been a successful investor for 20 years and currently owns properties in 11 states and 17 cities. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to financial freedom. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Hey, welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, and this is episode number 297 today. We're almost at the 300 mark, and thank you so much for your support. Thank you so much for spreading the word about the show and telling your friends and family and coworkers and acquaintances and your enemies, too. You got to tell everybody about the show. Anyway, today I've got Steve on the line and wanted to talk about a couple of news items and an email from a client. Steve, how are you?
Hey, pretty good, Jason. They've got more of me whether they like it or not here, but we've got some good stuff to go over.
There you go. Yeah. And hey, I've got to also announce that I'm glad to say we've been trying for a couple of years on this. We finally booked Steve Forbes on the show. So Steve will be coming on soon here in the next several episodes. We will have our interview with Steve Forbes and just a lot of good stuff. Boy, I did a great interview this morning that'll be broadcast soon with a true intellectual, Richard Epstein, and that was just a fascinating discussion about government and real estate and the tangled web the two weave. Just a whole bunch of good shows coming up here, so keep on listening, folks. But Steve, do you want to talk first today about IRS audit red flags?
Yes, we do. We do. There was a great article released by Kiplinger recently about the dirty dozen red flags that can get you in trouble, that are going to, of course, get the IRS's computers tipped off. And, you know, we don't want to do that if we certainly don't have to. And so there's a couple I just kind of want to highlight here. Some make sense. Others are complete typical government idiocy, as would be expected when we're talking about the IRS. But here's a shocker, Jason. You know what might get you audited?
What's that?
Making too much money.
Well, gosh. Yeah, that's true. And this is one of the reasons, actually, that people who are independent contractors like real estate agents, a lot of them try to incorporate and use an entity, because if you make a good living and you make $300,000-$500,000 a year, which is great, but it's not wealthy, contrary to what Obama and Pelosi would tell you. But if a corporation makes that much money, it's no big deal. If an individual makes that much money, it puts up a red flag in the IRS's cray computer and says, hey, this guy might be doing something. Interestingly, Steve, one of the ways that they catch a lot of the crooks, the drug dealers and so forth, is through tax evasion, not really catching them committing their crime. It's through tax evasion. That's what they actually end up prosecuting a lot of these guys for. So,
yeah, they're much more sophisticated at smuggling drugs around than they are laundering money, I suppose.
Yep, that's true. That's true. But yeah, so making too much money. What else do you want to say about that?
Well, yeah, real quickly, I had heard, and there may be no merit to this, but I had heard once upon a time that IRS agents, in order to audit a corporation, have to have a master's degree to be able to do that level of an audit. But your typical run-of-the-mill IRS employee can audit an individual. And so you can imagine people with master's degrees aren't exactly lining up to work for the IRS. Therefore, just by having the corporation, you decrease your chances. Sounds fun to say, whether it's true or not, I have no idea.
Yeah, and I just want to say, first of all, one of my corporations has been audited, and I just get the sense that the IRS is not going to come back and bother me again. Ever, probably, because I found so many new deductions that my accountant at the time, who I was dissatisfied with, didn't take, that the IRS ended up owing me a bunch of money. So, you know, I just get the sense they're not going to bother me for a while, but I may be wrong about that. The government isn't very logical, but I don't think my guy had a master's degree. You know, I don't know if he had a master's degree. That's interesting. He certainly didn't work too hard. The auditor came in every day and looked through the files for I don't know, several weeks. All my employees in the office knew him. He was a nice enough guy, but he wasn't too ambitious, and seems like he quit his day every day at about 1:30. Nothing like a government job, is there?
Right.
Yeah. But I don't know about that. That's interesting. Now, I do want to say, if any of you independent contractor type people, like real estate agents, or if you're running out to go incorporate a personal service business like that, that does carry a whole level of complexity with it that the lawyer who does it for you and wants to sell you his or her services will make it sound very simple. But of course, you have to file a whole other separate tax return. You got to keep separate books, and you know, you have to pay extra fees. And people that get entity crazy and want to set up all these entities, I'm just telling you, folks, a lot of you, I've said this before, you're putting the cart before the horse. There is more responsibility to it than it appears. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying that it makes life more and more complicated. It really does. So just be prepared for that. Anyway, yeah, I do kind of think that is logical, that a corporation making, you know, $500,000 doesn't raise the IRS's red flag like an individual does. So
who knows? I hope all of you listening never find out. Okay.
Hey, but I love tip number two. Now this is really rocket science. Failing to report all taxable income. You got to
right
report your
town.
Income. Yeah. I don't even know if we need to comment on that one.
No, I don't think so. There are a few others here, you know, on charitable deductions. One I like is claiming the home office deduction.
Yeah, that'll get you audited a lot of times because a lot of people abuse that one. But what do you want to say about the home office
well,
deduction?
You know, it can't be your home theater room or your gym that you worked in for 5 minutes that week. You know, you have to be able to prove that it is essentially 100% a home office. So, you know, the article goes on of, you know, if you legitimately have the deduction, don't not take it because you're afraid of an audit. You know, if you can prove it, let's get it. You know, no sense paying Uncle Sam or Uncle Geithner, whose last day is today, I believe.
Yeah. Who's he replacing Geithner with, by the way? I knew that, and then I forgot. Who's going in? Do you know?
I don't know. I'm guessing it's not going to be an upgrade.
Yeah, it never is.
But, yeah.
Yeah. TurboTax Timothy Geithner. He needs to learn how to do taxes.
Yeah, well, he's collecting them for the time being, so. Whatever.
Okay, good. Keep going.
Well, here's a good one. Claiming rental losses.
Ah, yes. So that's the depreciation phase-out rule. Is that what you're referring to?
Well, there's passive losses, and it's going into a little bit about being a real estate professional. And so people who are not really real estate professionals claiming that and claiming those kinds of losses. So, and that's something that we talk about a lot, obviously, is what it takes to become a real estate professional.
Yeah, let me mention two things on that one, Steve. First of all, depreciation on properties is like the gift from God. It is the best tax benefit I have ever heard of. I mean, income property is the most tax-favored asset in America, and I don't think anything else even comes close. And depreciation, if you can qualify for all of those depreciation write-offs, boy, what a huge, huge windfall that is. Like I've said many times, people, their eyes glaze over when we talk about taxes, but you've got to remember, folks, taxes are the single largest expense in anybody's life. You'll spend all sorts of time shopping around for a deal on a new TV set or a new car or the best deal on a trip that you want to take or vacation, yet, you know, not paying attention to taxes. And the people that get hurt the most on taxes are traditional employees. Active income is taxed at the highest rate. It is the least desirable type of income. Income from rental real estate, income properties with all of the other tax benefits combined is just a phenomenal opportunity. And what makes that gift from God like a double gift from God, once again, is the real estate professional qualification. If you can qualify for that, Wow. I mean, it's interesting, you know, people on the show, listeners, and I was kind of thinking about this recently, people on the show and my friends on Facebook, I will admit that I frequently rant about the evils and perils of big government and taxation, but, you know, honestly, I hardly pay any tax. I don't pay much at all compared to my level of economic status. because I have so many write-offs and I've learned how to play the game. I've learned how to do what the government wants me to do. I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm doing what they're incentivizing. And remember what I always say, what gets rewarded gets repeated. So they reward people for providing rental housing to people. So go out and do that. Folks, that's exactly what you should be doing, and you will find yourself saving on life's single largest expense. You know that old saying, Steve, it's not what you make, it's what you keep? A penny saved is a penny earned, Ben Franklin told us. Well, penny is meaningless nowadays. The meltdown value is worth more than the actual penny, same with nickels. But if you can go through life and you can make a big dent in eliminating 40% of your expense, which would go to taxation, okay, and maybe it's more than 40% if you live in a socialist state like California or New York or a few other ridiculously high tax states. But just on a federal level, you know, you're almost 40%. And then you've got a bunch of other types of taxes, of course. It's not just income tax. But think about it. Think about how much faster you can accumulate wealth and grow your legacy for your future and for your children if you don't pay that extra 40%. Think about it. If you had that extra 40% and you had that money to invest and go out and start a new business, buy more properties, just enjoy life more. I mean, it is unbelievable the compounding effect that has over just 3 or 5 years, much less 10, 20, or 30 years. I mean, you gotta pay attention to tax. Taxes are so important. Don't be bored by them. When you don't pay them, they get very exciting.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, they sure do. Anyway, any other thoughts on that one?
No, that's pretty good. You know, obviously, if you're going to claim real estate professional status, have a very serious talk with your accountant and make sure that you can legitimately claim that, because it's a gray area, but there are a few things that if you do them, you're generally going to be okay. And you can do what Jason says and avoid having that big chunk taken out of your pay before you even get to see it.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I just want to kind of correct something you just said. It's not a gray area. What I know what you meant by that, but there's nothing wrong with it. It's just an area that the IRS has been recently attacking a lot. You know, a lot of people just claim real estate professional status and they just don't qualify. They don't have They don't have the 500 hours material participation, the 750 hours total, the other requirements. And again, folks, this doesn't necessarily have anything to do with having a real estate license. Listen to the old podcast. One of the things, Steve, I want to remind people of is if you go to jasonhartman.com, we have such a huge library of content, and the vast majority of it is free, by the way. We do have some premium content for our members, but the vast, vast majority is totally free. Use the Google search bar up in the upper right-hand portion of the page, and you can just go there and type in real estate professional, and you can find the podcasts about it, the transcripts about it, the blog postings about it, and the resources about it. Our website is searchable, and it's free of advertising. We pay for that Google search bar there, and so any topic you want, just search it on jasonhartman.com, and you'll find a wealth of information. Anyway, do you want to talk about meals, travel, and entertainment, or did you want to? That one's kind of not a big deal for most people, but
yeah, not a big deal. Most of these are pretty self-explanatory. I think those are the most interesting ones. Obviously, running a cash business or failing to report a foreign bank account, people, it is certainly a buzz right now with what's going on in the States. People want to get some money offshore. There's a big movement for that, and you have to report those foreign bank accounts. It's not illegal to have one, at least yet. But yeah, you have to report that it's there. Foreign bank accounts are typically much more effective for asset protection than they are for taxes. It's not going to decrease your tax liability if you keep the money in Panama as opposed to here in the United States.
No, you got to declare all worldwide income. So if you're earning interest on that money in Panama or wherever, you got to declare it, obviously. So definitely. But you know what bugs the heck out of me, folks? And I tell you, be an activist on this, because I just can't stand when people are not paying their fair share. When I go into a restaurant or something, and it's like a quickie type restaurant where you get your food and go up to the cash register, and they don't ring it up, or their cash register isn't printing receipts, or they've got two cash registers there, or two cash registers and an adding machine. You know, I make them ring it up. I mean, that just irks the heck out of me that they're not declaring that income, and you know they're not doing it. And that's why I like to use credit cards and tip people on credit cards too, because you go get your hair cut and you usually pay in cash, and you know, a lot of that's not reported. But anyway, whatever.
Whatever. We just, you know, we want to help everybody stay off the IRS's radar if you can help it. You know, it's nobody wants to go through an audit if you don't have to. I mean, ugh.
There you go. No, it's a huge pain. It's a huge pain. Well, hey, what's the next item you want to discuss?
Well, there has been a lot of gold repatriation happening, and the gold bugs are in a frenzy. They're going nuts right now about this. 15 tons worth of gold hit the London J.P. Morgan vaults, meaning people are pulling it out of there. They're yanking the gold out of the J.P. Morgan vaults in London. What do you think's going on here?
Okay, look, folks. The gold bugs are making a big deal out of this, and I'm not saying it's meaningless. I'm just not saying it's not the big deal the gold bugs would have you believe. Germany repatriated a bunch of its gold, asked the U.S. to return it to Germany. Part of the reason for this, the reason the gold was kept in the U.S., which has always been known as like the Brinks truck of the world, because the U.S. is still considered largely the safe place. Chinese millionaires, a lot of them, their biggest wish is to either leave China, oddly enough, you know, even though they've made a lot of money there, or to at least move a lot of their assets offshore. And of course, the government puts up all kinds of obstacles. They put up what I call the economic Berlin Wall to try to keep people from doing this. And California is talking about things like that now, and our federal government is doing it too. You know, every country, well, not every country, but a lot of countries that especially feel threatened and see a brain drain, if you will, or in this case, a capital drain, try to stop that. And you know, it's interesting, just a little history here. I've been to Berlin, Germany twice, and I remember my first visit there years ago. I so wish I would have been there before the wall came down. It would just, you know, I have this morbid fascination with communism. I know I'm kind of weird, but I'm not saying I like it. I'm just fascinated by how backward an idea it is. And I remember I spent about 6 hours at the Checkpoint Charlie Museum, and literally looking at some of those exhibits, Steve, it brought tears to my eyes. It made me so angry that a government could be so evil that they could imprison people like that. And what happened, the whole reason the Berlin Wall went up is because the East started seeing this huge brain drain as people were leaving because there was no opportunity under communism. Of course, there's not. So there was a brain drain. So they tried to stop it by putting up that wall. And they put up that wall in a matter of days, literally. I think it was on one weekend, and I believe it was a holiday weekend, they literally had soldiers surround the city, or surround the eastern part of the city, I should say. And then they just put that wall up amazingly fast. And people were just suddenly prisoners of their own government. And so that's what happened. Now, how did this relate to the gold repatriation? Because it did relate. So the brain drain.
Hey, there
so,
you go.
So, you know, governments don't like the capital drain or the brain drain, obviously. But this repatriation thing, the gold bugs are saying, oh, this is a sign that the Germans, for example, don't trust the U.S. and they don't trust our central bank, which, listen, folks, I agree. Why should they? But a big part of the reason for these repatriations, which are happening in many countries, is that the countries no longer feel threatened the way they did in the Cold War era and in the post-World War II era, because these countries were just pillaged before by invaders, and they just don't view that as a major threat anymore. So if you don't view it as a major threat, well, why wouldn't you want your gold back in your own country behind your own borders? Of course you would.
Right.
You know, so I'm not saying I'm taking, I guess, a middle ground on it. The gold bugs are freaking out saying, oh, you know, this is a sign of the monetary system collapsing. And listen, folks, if you're a regular listener, you know I think our monetary system is completely bogus. So I'm not defending it. I'm just saying the fear of invasion is not what it was once was. So, of course, you want to have your gold in your own possession. Like I've mentioned on a prior show just recently, if you don't fear a home invasion robbery, if you own gold or other valuables, you'd keep it in your house. Now, I fear home invasion robbery because it happened to my grandparents. My grandfather was a coin collector. And home invasion robbery at gunpoint, My grandfather and grandmother were tied up. When the burglars came in, they hit the dog over the head with the butt of the pistol. Fortunately, nobody was seriously hurt or anything, but home invasion robbery, that's scary. If you own medals, do not keep them in your house. And I'm not saying you should keep them in a safe deposit box either, necessarily, because there's all kinds of dangers to that with bank holidays and so forth. I'm just saying, don't keep them in your house. You figure it out. Go ahead.
You know, there's a guy in my neck of the woods. It's been in the news, and he's in prison now. But, you know, some white collar stuff going on. And he is rumored to have stashed. He's a helicopter pilot. And he had apparently buried stashes of gold in various mountains and at the bottom of lakes throughout the Utah, Arizona, Colorado region. So you could do that. I mean, just get in your helicopter and go bury it.
There you go. Just everybody has a helicopter handy, I'm sure. So,
yeah, we've got to get our Obamacopters. Yeah.
But listen, the metals thing, the gold bug thing, it's way overplayed. Gold is a defensive strategy. It has all sorts of flaws to it. It's okay. It's probably better than paper dollars. But folks, this whole gold kick is just completely overplayed. You've heard me talk. I'm not going to talk about it now. I've done it before on other episodes. So listen to the past ones if you want to hear my opinions on gold. Yeah, I've beaten that horse pretty well. Let me take a brief pause. We'll be back in just a minute.
You know, Penny, sometimes I think of Jason Hartman as a walking encyclopedia on the subject of creating wealth.
Well, you're probably not far off from the truth, Rich. Jason actually has a 6-book set on creating wealth that comes with over 100 hours of the most comprehensive ideas on investing in business. They're in high-quality digital download audio format, ready for your car, iPod, or wherever you want to learn.
Yes, and by the way, he's recently added another book to the series that shows you investing the way it should be. This is a world where anything less than a 26% annual return is disappointing.
Jason actually shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets that are untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I like how he teaches us how to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
He's recorded interviews with Harry Dent, Peter Schiff, Robert Kiyosaki, Pat Buchanan, Catherine Austin Fitz, Dr. Dennis Waitley, T. Harv Eker, and so many others who are experts on the economy, on real estate, and on creating wealth.
And the entire set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered with a savings of $385.
Now, to get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series complete with over 100 hours of audio and 6 books, go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month, just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you.
Okay, next thing, what about a letter from a listener?
Yeah, we have a letter from Greg, one of our listeners, who has some interesting points that we wanted to kind of air out on the show here. I'll go ahead and read it. It says, "Hi, Jason. Love the information and guest interviews. I'm glad there's someone out there who still cares to enlighten and help the milking cows. I know you're a busy guy, and I have a few thoughts every time I listen to you that maybe you could cover. With the struggles our government has and their willingness to steal and plunder, will real estate make sense in the future? If things get really bad, would it be a far-fetched scenario where government takes ownership from the quote-unquote rich and evil landlords and transfers to the people or makes it immediately difficult to evict someone? If the economy really goes south and tenants don't have income, they can't pay their rent. Another thing I wonder is, does it make sense to stay and invest in the U.S. or even possibly diversify real estate holdings outside the U.S.? Do you see a place in an investor's portfolio to invest in overseas properties or even vacation properties? I wonder if these properties are priced too high or if it's too risky to have property management plus a language barrier to realize a decent return. Seems like it could be a good business expense to see these faraway properties. I love the show." He continues on, and doesn't this sound a lot like the end of times? Scary stuff. So he brings up a few things, a few interesting things, and one that I thought was interesting that I heard on another podcast where we continually talk on the show, Jason, about denominating our debt in the ever-weakening dollar. But one particular podcast who you listen to as well says, well, yeah, you could do that, but what's to stop the U.S. government from just doing what they did in Argentina? And, you know, denominating the debts in some new currency that's strong that they have, but your income is now denominated in the weak currency. And, you know, they're just changing the rules to totally screw everybody. And I think that's what we're getting at here.
Okay, so look, folks, there's several layers. We got to peel back this onion here. Several layers to this. First of all, the first thing is, if you're worried that the government is going to steal your real estate and take title to it, there's a couple of issues. Number one, I don't think you should have a lot of equity in your real estate. So it's your bank. And remember, the banks are in bed with the fascist government that we have, okay? I call it a socio-fascist government. So if your bank owns, in quotes, by virtue of having a lien or a loan or a mortgage on that property, if they own most of the property, then your risk is very low because maybe you only own 25 or 30% of it in terms of your equity position. And over time, if that's what you have to put down, hopefully in the future, as it appreciates, you're going to own a lot less, in other words, because you're going to refinance it, you're going to pull the money out of the property, and you're going to constantly engage in equity stripping, or what we call our refi till you die plan. And refi till you die is an excellent way to manage wealth and cash flow and so forth, and to extract wealth from your properties as you hold them over the years. Go to jasonhartman.com and the Google search bar, type refi till you die, and you'll see podcasts and articles and transcripts about it. So that's the first thing. I try not to have much equity in your real estate. Now, a lot of you listening are buying real estate with cash because you can't get any more loans. I completely understand that. I own several properties with cash also. I'd much rather have them leveraged, but I still think even owning them free and clear with cash is better than just about anything else you can do. The second best thing being private lending or hard money lending. But in this environment where you talk about where the like societal collapse type concept, you really don't want to be a lender in that scenario, okay? So the next issue, as we peel back the layers of the onion here, the next issue is that, remember, the thing that makes it hard for government to seize your property, and of course they can do it. They can do whatever they want. The government is omnipotent. But the thing that makes it hard for them to do that is the same thing that makes it very hard for the Wall Street bigwigs and the institutional investors to get into our business. It's very fragmented. I mean, folks, I want you to think about this. We have had a huge financial crisis over the last 4 years in this country. And the banks, they can't even figure out individual private enterprises where their own money is at stake. I would say Bank of America's, although I don't think they're brilliant by any means, I'd say they're a lot smarter than the government. Would you agree, Steve?
Not hard to do. It's not flattering to say so, but yeah.
Yeah. So they can't even figure out what assets they have, okay?
Right.
Do you really think the government can figure out the value of your properties? Do you think the government can really figure all this out? Do you think the government, if they seized it, they could manage it? Why would they seize it? What would they do? What would they do with it? Would they collect the rent from the other tenant? This is a highly fragmented industry, folks. And if you have money in a brokerage account or a bank, boy, the government, they can seize that real easy. Because that's just a computer transaction. That's real simple. And that's one of the reasons I think you've got to be very worried that there is going to be a seizure of retirement accounts in this country, 401ks and IRAs. And you have a lot less risk, as we've discussed in prior episodes, of that happening if you have a self-directed IRA. Because if the assets in your IRA, the government, they're going to come after the low-hanging fruit. Whatever is easiest to seize. A destitute, bankrupt government is not a pleasant one to live under because they're gonna attack assets. I agree. They're going to have capital controls, the economic Berlin Wall, if you will, and they're going to look for assets. And they're going to look for the low-hanging fruit, whatever is easiest. And the easiest stuff that's all a paper, electronic transaction that has an exact market value is the stock market. It's Wall Street. It's what's in your brokerage account, whether it be in a regular non-qualified account or a retirement account. That is low-hanging fruit. It's really simple for the government to go ahead and attack those assets and seize them, either through taxation or outright seizure. Then the next layer of the onion is, look, if you're worried about the government here, let's just get some perspective, folks. If you've done any traveling at all or any studying of what goes on geopolitically, what goes on in the rest of the world, history, if you've studied different countries and so forth. I mean, I love to travel. I've been to 64 countries so far. And the question you got to ask yourself there is like the next 10 commandments that I introduced at our last Meet the Masters event. And here's the question. Okay, the U.S. is a mess. The U.S. is bad. The U.S. government is becoming more restrictive, and they're restricting freedom, and they're becoming more intrusive. I completely agree. But the question is this. Compared to what? Compared to what? What other country really is that much freer than the U.S.? Well, there are several. And just so happens that the Heritage Foundation publishes an index of the freest countries. And I don't exactly agree with their idea of it. And here's one of the reasons. I do believe that the U.S. is becoming less free. I don't believe it's the freest country anymore. But I still think it's pretty darn good, all things considered. And one of the things that the U.S. has as a giant, giant asset to maintain freedom is it has a citizenry that believes in freedom. Other countries, even if they're freer, I would submit to you that the psyche of the people living in those countries is far different than the rugged individualist or even redneck mentality of people in the U.S., and I think that's a good thing. It's a compliment. And then you back that up with the fact that there are about 300 million guns in private hands in the United States. If you think the government is just going to roll over its citizens here, I think you really better check yourself. It's not going to happen without a fight in the U.S. And I don't mean necessarily a bloody battle. I just mean the government knows that they just can't get away. They got to be much more sophisticated about taking away freedoms in the U.S. And they are. They do it. And it's like boiling the frog. You put them in the warm water. You turn up the heat slowly. That's happening in the U.S. I completely agree. But folks, compared to what? I mean, when you combine the freedom issue and the attacks on our property and our liberty in the U.S., which are definitely happening, and you blend that with the amount of opportunity in the U.S., and one of the opportunities there is the mortgage opportunity, the fact that the federal government has subsidized housing since the Great Depression here. Yeah, you can go and buy real estate in other countries, and I've looked, believe me, I have looked extensively at other countries, and I haven't stopped looking. I mean, I talk to people from Brazil, property promoters down there and developers. I talk to people from Panama. I talk to people in Eastern Europe. I do this on a regular basis via email and via Skype and regular phone. I do that all the time, and I've looked at properties in these countries when I visited them, but they don't have a mortgage system. They don't have the system we have. So when you combine the freedom issue and the rights issue with the opportunity issue, I think the U.S. is far, far better than other countries in terms of real estate ownership. I just haven't found anything else that has even come close. And listen, if it did, there's nothing to keep us. Steve, we could be recommending properties in, you know, in Myanmar, Burma, that recently opened up and became free and communism failed there. We could promote properties in oh gosh, how many, I get so many calls from people wanting to promote Mexico properties, Panama properties, Costa Rica properties, Nicaragua properties. We haven't done any of this because I don't like the deals. I don't think they're very good. If you ever have a bad experience with a U.S. property and you think, oh God, I got a deadbeat tenant, I had to evict them, you think it's tough doing that in the U.S.? Just try it in Nicaragua or Belize, folks. Are you kidding me? I mean, come on.
Right.
Steve?
Yeah. You're compared to what analogy there is absolutely right. Some of these markets, you know, it's the allure of speculation. It's an emerging market. It's Nicaragua and everything's going up. It goes against everything that we're talking about. You know, yeah, you can win big in speculation and people do. But when the deal makes sense from day one, as is part of the Ten Commandments, then you're always going to win steadily. Win big, lose big. Those are your chances when you're speculating on some newly emerging market. But if something were to stabilize and have good solid rule of law and there was a system to invest there and the deals made sense from day one, that would be something we could potentially consider.
In America, we still have pretty good rule of law. Of course, it's being watered down. I'll be the first to agree. But compared to what, folks? I mean, you have rights in America. You have lots of rights. And that's kind of one of the problems. People are so busy worrying about their rights all the time, they're rolling over other people with their so-called rights. But compared to what? I agree, it's getting scarier here, but all that's happening is the U.S. is descending into sort of European-style socialism. There's lots of rich people in Europe. Europe, for decades, did pretty well. And you got to remember something. Economics and prosperity are relative concepts. So, yes, people in the U.S. are getting poorer. Yes, it's going to be harder for people to pay their rent. Yes, the standard of living, in my opinion, is declining in the United States. It's not as good as it was. We were living on a smoke and mirrors economy for decades here. It's not what it used to be. I don't think it is, okay? Now, things may change if we start to finally exploit our natural resources, and we have abundant natural resources in this country. The mining, the oil, the gas, the natural gas. There, North Dakota, wow. The Gulf Coast. I mean, we have abundant resources here if we can get the tree huggers out of the way and the special interest out of the way and actually get at those resources. This is a very prosperous country, no question about it. The problem is we haven't been mining those natural resources, and what we've been doing is building an economy for several decades now based on an entitlement society and a smoke and mirrors Wall Street economy that's fake. We have real hard prosperity here, real hard resources here that if we can get at them and Obama will get out of the way and, you know, let a Keystone pipeline occur, I mean, this country is rich beyond measure, okay? And ultimately, I think, like I've said before, I think environmentalism is the luxury of a rich society. And as we become poorer, more of these resources will be exploited. And I think that's good. I think we should exploit the resources because, you know, we need to. They're ours. Why should we be buying them from terrorist governments or pseudo-terrorist rogue governments in the Middle East? I mean, that's just nuts. It makes no sense at all.
Yep, you're correct. But, you know, in any case, all of this a little doomy and gloomy here, but people still do need a place to live. So short of the government completely nationalizing every last piece of property, you still benefit from being a landlord and owning properties. And it's just, as you say, how on earth could they ever do that?
Yeah, it's just too fragmented, Steve. It's just too fragmented. But, you know, there's actually two more issues you just reminded me we should address here. One is that the Argentina concept, that the government could say, okay, like I always say, denominate your assets in things and denominate your liabilities in depreciating fiat currencies like the dollar. Because as those dollars depreciate, your debt is paid off. And as those dollars depreciate, the value of your things, the commodities, the ingredients to the house or apartment building you own, they appreciate and at least keep pace with inflation, if not exceed it sometimes. So that's a very good strategy. Now, could the government come along like they did in Argentina? And by the way, I only know of one example of that where it was done. And what are they going to do in the U.S.? I mean, Argentina said, okay, the dollar is our benchmark. And in the Eastern European countries that I visited a few years ago, I took a real estate tour of five Eastern European countries. Where did I go? I went to Estonia, I went to Latvia, I went to Romania, I went to Bulgaria. And is that five or is that four? I don't know. Anyway, you weren't counting? Darn. Anyway, I went to five Eastern European countries, okay? And I looked at real estate in every country. I set up my appointments in advance. I went and looked at properties there. And all of them, without exception, denominated the mortgages in the euro. Even in, for example, Bulgaria, which had joined the European Union, they were an EU member, they had just joined that year. but they still hadn't changed their currency. They were not on the euro. Okay, they were a member of the union, but not on the euro. So they denominate their mortgages, their debt, if you will. Now, they don't even have mortgages now, so far as I know, but they did have some inkling of mortgages back then, that the terms were lousy. It was not a good deal. But that was right as the banking crisis was just setting in. Okay, and they did have some mortgages. And this 30-year mortgage concept is like a uniquely U.S. concept, and it's wonderful. Take advantage of it in the U.S. But they did that. But what would the U.S. say? I mean, think about it. If the U.S. tried to do something like that, like saying, okay, all you people, your liabilities, we're going to stick it to you, and all the liabilities are going to be denominated in what? Okay, the dollar is the reserve currency of the world. Maybe it won't be forever, but what are they going to say? Can you imagine this slap in the face it would be to the United States? The admission of total, complete loss of hegemony as a world power to say, okay, we're not denominating your mortgages in dollars. We're going to denominate your mortgage in the euro. Can you imagine? That would never happen here.
I mean, that's not going to fly here.
That would just never happen. A country like Argentina, yeah, they could say it because they never thought they were a global power. They could have been 100 years ago. You know, they had the makings of it. Argentina was a rich country, but it just, the corruption really set in there and it became a mess over and over again. So that's the Argentina issue, okay? Then the next issue, which I don't think is possible in the U.S., okay? But hey, I don't know. Maybe it is somehow. I can't figure it out. If you're a listener and you can figure it out, call into the show and debate this with me, discuss this with me, give me a new idea, because I don't want to be like just stuck to my own thinking here. You know, I need you to question me because it makes me think, okay? I want to hear your opinion. So call into the show. But the other issue is the issue of, okay, no, if it's going to get so bad here, like you said, Steve, and the listener said in this email, will anybody be able to afford the rent? And like we've discussed, they will be able to afford something. It may be a shack. It may be a mansion. It's probably leaning more toward a shack and a lower-end home. The housing that they can afford is not a fixed, static thing. That's a fluid, dynamic thing. So they'll live somewhere. They'll pay rent somewhere. It's just going to be a lesser place than they were used to in the past. That is a moving target. And you're going to catch in your rental properties, we believe with, and Steve, at the Meet the Masters event, you did a great job introducing and kind of clarifying for all of the people who attended the concept of tier one, tier two, and tier three properties. Do you want to just explain that to the listeners now?
Yeah, sure. I can explain that, you know, and it's not a total catch-all, but it's how we're defining the kinds of properties, you know, that you can buy through the network, you know, and tier one up through tier three, that's typically your return is going up and so is your risk as you progress from tier one to tier three. But it's, you know, it's a pretty simple process. On the tier one properties, they're going to be newer. They're going to be properties, you know, built in the 90s and newer. And you're
Maybe built in 2007.
That's right, 90s and newer. And sometimes, you know, we peak down into the late 80s, but newer construction, less rehab, and you're almost always going to get $1,000 a month or more in rent for those kinds of properties.
So that's tier one. So I'd say those are like $1,000 to $1,600 in rent. And we're, of course, folks, as Steve's talking about this, talking about single family homes.
Yes, correct. And like I said, this is a pretty good grouping of the properties. It's not always 100% correct, but it's a very good way to think of this.
It's a guideline.
Yeah, a guideline. You know, in your tier two properties, well, and back to those tier ones, you're going to buy those for anywhere from $90,000 on the low end on up to about $150,000.
Right. And remember, this is early 2013 when Steve is saying that. If you listen to this show, because our shows stay up, right? Most of them do.
Yep.
If you listen to this show in 2014, just add $20,000 to any of those prices, maybe more, okay, depending on the inflation rate. But go ahead, Steve.
It's true. I did have a private equity fund offer $7,000 more per door on a couple of properties yesterday than was the builder's asking price.
Yeah.
So
and,
it's
and
already
by, climbed. By the way, we ought to talk about how you've been representing some hedge funds and private equity lately in buying properties, but we don't have time. Go ahead. We'll talk about that
another day.
Yeah,
another day. Right. But, you know, your tier two stuff, everybody, that's you know, you buy those for anywhere from $70,000 on up to the high 80s, and, you know, usually built in the 60s through the 80s, and a much more narrow rent range of about $850 to $1,000. But there's a lot of properties in that tier two level. And then finally, you get into tier three. These are the older properties, typically built in the 40s, 50s, sometimes even older. And it's a very big rehab to do those properties. You know, a lot more has to be considered. But you can also buy them for $50,000 to the high 60s, and they rent for $700 to $850 a month. So you see that, you know, your RV ratio, rent-to-value ratio on the tier threes is very high, but your risk has gone up a little bit with, you know, vacancy and maintenance. So it's tier threes are what really experienced investors have to do. Like Jason always says, and when you invest in income property, you feel the bumps. You're not investing into a mutual fund where there's a fund manager on the other end and owners of companies and managers that deal with all the day-to-day problems of a business. When you invest in income property, that's you and your property manager. And so tier three, higher return, a little bumpier. If you want a more smooth ride, but not quite as much of a return, you'd go tier one, and two's in the middle. And most of our clients end up diversifying out, and they learn as they invest which one they prefer and in which markets they like to do that.
Yeah, so they might buy a few properties in tier one and a few in tier two and a few in tier three. And some markets, we only have one of the tiers. Some of the markets, we have all three tiers. So that's why your investment counselor is here to help you with that and to consider your risk tolerance, your time horizon, your goals as an investor, whether they be more capital appreciation oriented or more cash flow oriented. I mean, generally, our whole strategy is cash flow oriented, but we do have some that skew one way or another on the continuum. So that's what Steve and our other investment counselors are here to help you do, determine what is right for you and what kind of mix is right for you, if any. Maybe you're a 100% tier one or a 100% tier three investor. But the point as it relates to this letter, just our last point on it, is that someone may have lived in, for example, a tier one house today when things were better. And as the economy worsens and as the country becomes more broke and as the inflation rate increases, they move down to tier two and then they move down to tier three and they have memories of the good old days when they used to be more prosperous. And I say that the standard of living is going down. They're not going to live in the same house. That's not a fixed thing. They're going to pay rent. They're going to be able to afford to pay it. It's just a question, what will they be afford to rent?
Yeah,
that's the question. It's not
they'll
a
downgrade
fixed thing.
The car. They'll get the basic DirecTV package. They'll cut their cell phone minutes. That's just the reality of what's going to have to be done as things continue to inflate.
Yep. Just ask the folks in Greece and other European countries about austerity measures.
Yes.
Yeah, it's there you go. Okay. Well, hey, Steve, you know what? As we do so often, we went long. I don't know if we have time for a guest. I'm going to let our producer decide whether there's time for a guest here. And depending on what guests we have in the can here that we've already recorded, we might just put a caller up. We might have a short guest, or we might just conclude the show. So whatever happens next, folks, I'm leaving that up to our producer, and we will talk to you either way on the next episode. Hey, it's my pleasure to welcome Matt to the show. He's a caller and a listener from New Hampshire, beautiful place up there in the Northeast. Matt, how are you?
Doing very well, Jason. How are you?
Good, good. Well, hey, thanks for calling the show. And I got your email a few days ago, and I know you had some questions about financing and some other things. How can I help?
Yeah, so my main question would be that a lot of your philosophy is based on locking in long-term fixed-rate debt, and that's a good option up to, you know, your first four properties. That seems to be the Freddie Mac limit, you know, the government-imposed limit there. So after that, you're forced to move into commercial financing. And what I've had some trouble finding is commercial financing that is of the same structure, a 30-year loan with a fixed rate. A lot of the commercial financing seems to be ARMs, or maybe you can get a 20-year term, but with a high interest rate. So I just was kind of wondering what your experience has been with that?
You know, Matt, this is such a great question because, you know, I have long said on the show, and you've heard me say this before, that the thing that makes U.S. housing, American housing, such an attractive deal is that ever since the Great Depression, it's been subsidized through Fannie Mae, then Freddie Mac. And these 30-year incredibly low fixed-rate mortgages are a uniquely American thing. And you can do them in a few places around the world, but they're not as good as the U.S. So it's a great question, and I completely understand your concern and frustration having to jump to commercial financing. So first of all, it actually, the old limit was 4. We have lenders that can do 10 now, okay? So you can do up to 10 residential mortgages, and if you're married, you can do 10, and your spouse can do 10, so you can really do 20. So if you're single, it may be a reason to get married. Just for that reason, if not anything else.
Yeah, right. don't tell her that.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. But so you can do up to 20. Now, of course, if it's just for people who are married, you know, you have to understand both spouses have to qualify individually. So if you have a non-working spouse, then they're not going to be able to qualify for their 10. So you've got to both be earning an income and be able to qualify for loans, obviously. So that's the first thing, up to 10 or 20, really. But let's talk about what happens after 10 or 20, because we have clients that are buying 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 properties from us. And it's a real challenge. So the first thing that you really have to pay attention to is what I call mortgage sequencing, okay? And so far as I know, I'm the one who just coined that term, okay? But mortgage sequencing is important because the order in which you do these loans, in some of our markets, you've heard us talk about how we have some special, unique sort of commercial or hybrid residential commercial financing. And you don't want to use these special financing vehicles we have until you've maxed out your 10. You want to first get your regular Fannie Freddie 10 loans out of the way and then do the special financing. So the mortgage sequencing becomes a real issue that you want to pay attention to, because if you jump too early and take advantage of one of these unique products we have, then you might be taking away from what you can do conventionally on the very best financing of all, the Fannie Freddie financing.
Okay. Yeah.
Commercial financing, just like you said, Matt, is definitely not as desirable. The typical commercial loan will be a 5 to 7 year fixed rate, maybe up to 10 years, and then it'll be adjustable after that. And the rates will never be as low as residential. They're always a little bit higher. And now there is an advantage to commercial financing. I might as well mention that here. Because if you're looking to do big, big stuff, okay, and by big, I mean apartment complexes with loan amounts over, say, $3 or $4 million, then that commercial financing actually becomes very attractive in a whole different way. Again, the rates won't be as good. It won't be long-term fixed like the residential. But in many cases on the bigger stuff, you don't actually have to qualify for the loan. The property does the qualifying for you. So that's
right.
Cool.
I was aware of that. And that was kind of a follow-up question I had, because I've heard you talk about some of these bigger deals that you've done. I was wondering how your loans were structured on those.
Yeah, well, my biggest property is a 125-unit apartment complex. And on that one, I have partners. And one of the partners did personally guarantee a portion of that loan when we refinanced. But get this, we got a 10-year fixed rate for, I think it was, God, I can't remember the loan amount offhand, but I think it was $3.4 million on the refinance of that property. And at 4.6%. That's pretty good, huh?
Yeah, wow.
I thought that
now, was that amortized over a longer period? Or is
Forgive me, I did that loan like 9 months ago, so I can't remember all the terms, but I think it was amortized over 30 years, and it goes adjustable after the 10th year.
That does seem like a really good really good structure then.
It was a very good deal. It was a very good deal. But on loan amounts, generally the commercial loans that don't require the investor themselves to qualify, and sometimes they don't require any personal guarantee at all. It'll just be the property only, you know, in certain cases. On those types of properties, it's usually a loan amount above $3 million, maybe $4 million, depends on the lender. So again, much larger deals. But there is that advantage to commercial financing. Now, the other interesting thing about commercial financing that I should also mention is that it starts to really, they start to actually look at your resume. And what I mean by resume, you know, you're thinking a resume only applies if you want to get a job, right? Well, this resume is, have you owned larger investment properties before? How did they go? Have you managed them from a distance? Have you owned out of state larger investment properties? So they actually look at the resume of the investor also, which is kind of a fairly new concept, really. You know, a lot of it born out of the financial crisis, because there was also a problem in the commercial financing and the apartment financing world too, not just residential subprime that we all hear about. So that's kind of another aspect of it that's sort of interesting.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that. That is that one kind of follow-up I would ask is that the 4 versus the 10 for the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, some lenders I've been in touch with have said that they still will follow only the 4 guidelines. And I was just wondering if it's through your network, if you have had to kind of pick and choose and find lenders that will actually go up to the 10. I've had a lot of difficulty actually finding lenders that will go past 4.
Yeah, you know what? We have had to pick and choose. And one of the things I should just let all the listeners know about that is that when you're financing an investment property, it really is a specialty in the lending world. So we work with lenders that just finance investors. That's all they do, some of our people. Like if you want a loan to refinance your house or buy a new home for yourself, some of our lenders don't even do that. It's just not their thing at all. So it is a specialty in the lending world. And we get a lot of calls and a lot of email from lenders who are saying, hey, you know, I do home mortgages. It looks like you sell a lot of homes. You know, refer some clients to me. No, that's not our thing. We need someone who really specializes in investors. And we only have a couple of lenders that we refer business to because investor financing, it is a specialty and it has some real nuances to it. So any of our investment counselors can refer you to the right lenders that can do what you need.
That's good to know. I heard you talk about it a lot and I was having trouble myself finding ones that would go up to 10. So it is kind of a specialty thing. I thought that would be the case, but I get your sense on that as well.
Yeah. Well, hey, does that kind of answer your financing question? I know you wanted to maybe chat about a couple other things, but I just wanted to make sure I addressed what you needed there.
It does. The only kind of last follow-up would be, I guess I'll give you a little background on myself too as well. I might give a little perspective to this. I'm actually a pretty young guy, just got into the real estate investment, but I've been partnering with my dad, who has a lot more cash on hand to do this, but isn't around to manage and get some of these deals going. So one thing with us that's been another sort of obstacle obstacle is the right word, is that we want to go into this and share ownership in these properties. And what we found is that the best way to do that is through closing into an LLC or moving the title into an LLC after purchase. I was wondering if that is something that your clients typically have done, or if you had any thoughts about how to partner on a property and actually share ownership of that property.
The whole LLC thing is, I'm glad you asked this, because it is very problematic. I've just got to tell you, okay?
It has been, for sure.
Right, and how has it been a problem, by the way? Just tell the listeners, what has been the problem with it?
So our experience is that you can't get normal residential financing and close into an LLC. The banks just won't allow it. You have to go commercial right off the bat. So another option that you can do is that you can move the property into an LLC after you get your financing, your residential financing. The risk with that we've run into is that if you do that, the bank has the right to ask for the full loan amount upon transfer of the title.
Right. And just to tell everybody, what that's called is that's called a due on sale clause. Okay. It's something that the Supreme Court of the United States upheld back in the 70s, maybe 1978. I'll just take a guess. I can't remember. But yeah, the due on sale clause has been upheld and the lender could call the loan due technically. So you got to be careful with that. And there's another problem too. I don't know if you're going to mention it or if you've discovered it yet, but has there been another problem?
The other problem, at least in New Hampshire, I'm not sure, that's where we've bought a few properties. I'm not sure how it is in every other state, but you would trigger a transfer tax due to the state upon the transfer of title, which I believe in New Hampshire is 1.5% of the sale price or the value of the property. So that's another big chunk of cash right out of your pocket if you want to try to do that. Now, there are, you know, some advantages, and maybe you could argue if it's worth it or not. But those are the two main issues you run into. Third one, though, is insurance. The insurance is different and more expensive to get if you try to do an LLC.
Right. So, yeah, the insurance is the one I was going to mention. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, so that's difficult to get around. And so I guess my question is, we haven't actually done any of this because of these risks and these negatives. Right now, I'm holding one property and my dad's holding two more. We'd like to somehow get this so that we can partner on it, but maybe we'll do that moving forward and not for these first few.
Right. So typically, because the LLC is problematic, okay, and I tell you folks, the lawyers out there and all of these companies that do, I call them mills because they're like production mills where they just kick out paperwork without really thinking. That's my definition of a mill. And they're not even attorneys. You know, LLCs for $99. It's amazing the price differences too. You can type in online and there's all kinds of companies that offer LLCs for $99. And then if you go to a lawyer, well, it's $2,000, you know, or $800. It's just, it's amazingly all over the board. And I've never been able to get any of them to sort of really distinguish the difference. But they try to say, well, you know, you got to put this in the operating agreement and this and that. And they may be right. You know, I don't want to minimize the value of good legal advice because it can be extremely valuable. But they've done such a good job of marketing, get an LLC, and they never talk about the problems that we just talked about. And for the residential investor, meaning four units and under, the LLCs, they make it very troublesome. I mean, the environment out there is not set up to hold property in an LLC if you've got property four units and under. So if you've got single-family homes, duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, it's really tough. You got to just really hold them in your own name unless you want to create a bunch of additional cost and complexity. And, you know, people say, well, Jason, what about asset protection? Well, folks, have you heard of insurance? I mean, what is so wrong with insurance? You know, I've owned lots of rental properties. I've had hundreds of tenants over the years. I have never been sued by a tenant, okay? I've never had a tenant slip and fall and sue me for something, okay? It could happen, certainly, but that's why you have insurance, folks. And insurance, a good insurance policy, make sure you keep it up, don't let it expire, can really cover most of the liability problems. I don't want to say it covers everything because there's always an exception, but it really is the way to go. So beyond that, what typical small investors do is they do what's called a tenant in common agreement. A tenant in common agreement. Now, a tenant in common agreement is how you hold title. You can hold title either in joint as joint tenants, and joint tenancy has what they call the right of survivorship. So this is typically done with a husband and wife, because if one passes away, they want the property to go to the other one. That's called right of survivorship. But if you're doing it with an investor, okay, where you're both going in on a deal, you would probably want to take title as tenants in common, meaning there's no right of survivorship. You could will your half to whoever you want, and your partner could will their half to whoever they want. And that's typically the way that is done. Now, I do have to make the disclaimer. I am not a lawyer. I can't give legal advice. And I'm not a tax expert. I can't give tax advice. I'm just kind of speaking from my experience and my own knowledge. Check this all out with the appropriate professional. But that's typically what happens, okay, is a tenant in common agreement.
Okay. All right.
Now, with your dad, though, especially if you're an only child, you could do joint tenants, actually, because the right of survivorship, you might already intend that.
Yeah. So one thing that I would wonder about is now, like, coming back to the limit of 10 properties per person, that would only be applied to mortgages. So one person could back the mortgage or guarantee the mortgage in their name, and then you could take title and tenants in common or right of survivorship, and that wouldn't kind of use one mortgage from each person to finance that property. Is that correct?
Well, maybe.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's a question for the bank, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. It's a question for the lender. The lenders make it fairly difficult. So it's a question for your lender. It depends. It's complicated. How's that? It's like Facebook, you know, relationship status. There's a choice called it's complicated. And the lender can make that difficult. But, you know, I don't want to say it can't be done. I'm just saying the lender can make it difficult.
Yeah. Well, that's another tack to put some research into. It's something I haven't looked into too much. So that's
sure. Sure. Now, can I ask you this? When did you become interested in real estate? You said you were a young guy. You know, if you want to tell your age or anything, you're welcome to.
Yeah, yeah. I'm 23. I'm just out of college for a year now. And I've been somewhat interested in it since I was in college. And my grandfather and uncle are both into real estate in one way or another. So there's a little bit of a family that brought some general knowledge of it. But when I was in college, I didn't have any money, and so it was not going to be optimal time for me to get started. But I got out and got a job as a software engineer, so I'm making some money now, and I decided that now is the time to get started. There's no time like the present. And so I started researching, reading books, listening to your podcast, looking up articles online, and I just bought my duplex this past summer. Actually, I'm living in one half, running the other half out. It's a great setup. I think that the rent covers almost all of the mortgage, insurance, and taxes. So
I just have to make the disclaimer there. I don't recommend officially living next door to your tenants.
Oh, is that right? You had a bad experience?
No, I haven't had a bad experience, but I've heard of some. So, you know, I just have to put it out there that it's not a recommendation I would make. But I'm glad your experience is good so far, definitely.
Yeah, I can see it wouldn't be for everyone. Yeah. But, you know, it's at least from my viewpoint is that the financial gain you can be had from it. For me, you know, I have a pretty high tolerance for risk, and if problems come up, I don't get too worried about them. So for me, it was a good decision, and, you know, we obviously did a lot of extra screening on the tenants before we let them into the other half of our house. So, but my strategy is to try to, because my dad's very interested as well, and he's actually overseas, so the reason that I'm managing this is because he's in China, and He's been interested in it, but he couldn't, you know, go around and kind of learn and look at some properties the way I've been able to. So our strategy now is to kind of expand as quickly as possible. We bought a few properties in state. We'd like to start looking out of state and maybe looking at bigger deals. But we feel that this time, and you've echoed this many times on your show, is that the time now has been no better in history probably. So
that's
kind of our strategy.
This probably is, I mean, I know it sounds like a typical salesman, but this probably is the best time in history to be an investor. I mean, it is just, you know, as long as you're doing it right, boy, the timing just couldn't be better, could it? It's pretty darn good. So how long have you been listening to the podcast?
I started listening to it beginning of this year, so I guess maybe February, and I think I've went through maybe 150, 180 episodes now, so not every single one, but I think I've got the philosophy down a little bit now, and Now it's execution.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, is there anything else I can answer for you?
No, I think that wraps up all the questions I have. I really appreciate you taking some time out of your day and giving me some good knowledge and good tips to go out and try some new things, I guess.
Yeah, well, the pleasure is all mine. And Matt from New Hampshire, I just want to wish you happy investing. Thanks for calling the show.
Thank you, Jason.
Jason provides an extremely unique service, Deal Evaluator. Are you interested in a property outside of our network? Need a second opinion? No problem. Let our experts evaluate the deal. Find out more about it at jasonhartman.com. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.